This podcast is part of the Gun Rights Radio Network, podcasting freedom.
Howdy, folks. Welcome to the Liberals Gun Corner, where liberalism and the Second Amendment shake hands and do a group hug. I'm your host, Cowboy T, San Francisco liberal with a gun. This is our second episode, a.k.a. episode number two. Quick recap of last episode. I gave you my view on what liberalism really is and what it ought to be, and that by definition it must include a complete respect for the Second Amendment to our Constitution. Seems this raised quite a few eyebrows, just about all of them favorable, thank goodness, because y'all have guns. Well, I even got a few remarks that I sound more like a libertarian and might even like Representative Ron Paul's platform. Someone came up with the neologism liberaltarian. I like that. Who knows? It may be right. Well, matter of fact, we're going to talk about that, this liberal versus libertarian notion on a future show. I think it's a topic worth exploring further. But since we talked so much about politics the last time, well, this time we're going to have just as strong a focus on the other aspect of the liberals' gun corner. Guns! And since I'm a San Francisco liberal with a gun, or two, I gotta tell you, I just got back from the range with my newest acquisition. It, along with three of its brethren, are going to be the subject of this episode. Basically, we're going to talk about gun types that I think are really cool, what makes them cool, and why you might want to consider one of the type. The four general types we'll be talking about are as follows. 1. Lever guns. 2. Double action revolvers. 3. Military surplus bolt action rifles. And 4. Semi-auto pistols. Any of these, any of them, are recommended for a typical gun owner or gun owner to be. Each type has its pluses and minuses, depending on the situation. For each type, I'll use a representative model. In all cases, it's one that I happen to use. Yeah, actually use at the gun range where I work because we rent them, or one that I own myself. So this isn't like, you know, some of those folks who've never actually fired the gun. These are all guns I've actually had some quality time with. The lever guns will be represented by Ruger's Model 96/44, revolvers by the Ruger Red Hawk, the military surplus bolt action rifles by Russia's Mosin Nagant M9130, comrade, and the semi-auto pistols by Ruger's SR series. Yeah, I know. That's a lot of Rugers there. I know. No, I don't work for them. No, I don't get sponsored by them. I wish. Remember, I promised to explain why I think each gun is really cool, and I will get into that. So, let's get started with number one. Lever guns! Oh. Not everyone's heard of them, but most people have probably seen one. They look just like what Annie Oakley used to use back in the late 19th and early 20th century. I'm really hopped up about these now because, like I said, I just got back from the range with my newest acquisition, a lever gun chambered in 44 Magnum. See, I've been wanting a lever gun chambered in a revolver cartridge for a little while now. For those of you who don't know, typical revolver cartridges are your 38 Special, your 357 Magnum, 44 Special, 44 Magnum, 45 Colt, also known as 45 Long Colt, and yeah, there are others. Originally, I was looking at a Marlin 1894C and 357 Magnum, or maybe a Rossi Model 92 or a Puma Model 92, with a preference for the Marlin because I like the scopeability of it. I fired all three of these, and all of them are fine rifles. They're also really popular. Matter of fact, they're so popular they don't stay in stock for very long. Makes it kind of hard to get a good deal on one when they're flying off the shelves like that. So, you know, what's going on with that? Well, big part is the Single Action Shooting Society, or the cowboy action shooters. You may have heard of them, you know, the guys with the cowboy guns and all that, and gals, by the way. They buy these lever guns up like crazy. Well, guess who else likes them? Deer hunters out on the East Coast, because they're very effective on deer. A 357 Magnum, 44 Magnum, or 45 Colt rifle will drop that deer right there. All this, of course, assumes proper shot placement. Turns out they also get the job done on wild hogs and even black bears. The reason for that's kind of beyond the scope of this particular podcast, but, well, you know, maybe we'll do a section on the ballistic benefits of shooting revolver cartridges out of rifles later on down the road. Suffice to say, for now, that there are significant benefits. Well, a couple weeks ago, I became the proud new owner of one of these lever guns, the Ruger Model 96/44. That's that company's Model 96 lever action series, chambered in Dirty Harry's favorite cartridge, the 44 Magnum. No, it's not the most powerful in the world anymore, no. Now, there have been, you know, later developments, like the Super Magnums, like the 454 Casull, the 460 S&W, the 475 Limbaugh, and even the 500 S&W Magnum. But, you know, that 44 Magnum, it's still just as powerful today as it was when it first came out in 1956. Yeah, that's still pretty powerful, by the way. You definitely don't want to get hit with one. We'll just say that, okay? Now, I'm holding this Ruger 96-44 in my hands. Listen to the lever action. Sounds kind of like a shotgun, doesn't it? Well, it's basically Ruger's slightly updated copy of Savage's Model 99 design. It's a pretty modern-looking lever gun. For those of you who've seen a 10-22... imagine a 10-22 with a lever. That's exactly what it looks like. You take the base model 10-22 with the blued finish, the wooden rifle stock, and the barrel band. Okay, got that picture? Okay, now, add a lever and increase the bore size. Boom, you just did it. You have the 96-44. Same sights, same basic dimensions, similar weight. Matter of fact, I have it sitting right next to my 10-22 right now, and the resemblance really is eerie. When I say it's basically Bill Ruger's copy of the Savage 99 design, I'm not kidding there either. It's got that modern, sleek look. It's even got the little brass pop-up indicator that says, "The hammer is cocked," you know, on the rear of the receiver, the back of the receiver, just like the Savage 99. The rifle stock, it is the classic M1 Garand straight-back design. It's made out of Ruger's normal stained birch wood, like a 10-22. One nice touch. The receiver is made to take the Ruger scope rings like you see on, for example, your Super Red Hawks, your Mini 14s, your Model 77s, and so on. So it's really easy to scope this rifle if you want. The magazine is a box rotary type, basically a bigger bore version of the 10-22's type, rather. Holds four rounds. You can also feed one manually into the chamber, so the rifle's really a 4+1. Now, all that sounds good, but what makes it so cool that I'd be going on about it like this on the Liberals' Gun Corner? Well, a few things. First, this rifle shoots really well. Well, that's the bottom line with any gun, isn't it? Better shoot. You know, how well does it do that? Well, tonight at the range was the second time I'd shot it at all. So far, I've put 25 rounds through it, which isn't that many, but it was enough to get to know the gun. At our range's max distance of 22 yards, my last five rounds went into a quarter-sized group using the iron sights. Remember, I'm new to this gun. I will get better with it, but that's just like first picking it up. Obviously, the rifle shoots better than I can right now. Now, since the 10-22 is so popular, remember, basically all the controls except the lever are in the familiar spots. It's just an overgrown 10-22 with a lever. You can have multiple magazines, like a 10-22, ready to go for fast reloading. The built-in open iron sights are just like a 10-22's. It means they're pretty good. Well, I think so. And now I got to say something about the lever action of this rifle. My God, it is smooth. I've got a buddy who's used his dad's old Winchester 94. You know, that's been the traditional gold standard for lever guns ever since. He says that Winchester 94 is pretty smooth. Well, duh, it better be, given A, it's a Winchester, and they've always made good guns. And B, it's an older Winchester. That is, it's seen plenty of use. It's long since been broken in. He also has a newer lever gun in 45 Colt. I think it's a Marlin 1894. Well, this rifle is much less smooth than the Winchester. I let him try out this 96-44. He was astonished at how smooth the action is. Told me it's not just smoother than his dad's Winchester, it's a lot smoother. I believe his exact words were, "That's on a whole nother level." You know, having worked a number of lever guns before myself, I have to agree. This 9644 also looked like it hadn't been used much at all before I got it, so it looks like that's just how they came from the factory. One other important little point. The lever throw is pretty short. That means you can fully actuate the lever without taking your hands off of the rifle stock. What that means is you can make quicker follow-up shots if you need to. Looks like Ruger really did this one right. And, of course, like other lever gun models, it shoots the popular 44 Magnum cartridge. It's already a powerhouse out of a revolver. But when you stick that cartridge in a rifle-length barrel, it becomes a whole nother animal. Really, we're talking 30-30 levels of energy now, and I remind you, the 30-30 is an actual rifle round. We are in that kind of class now. 100 yards or closer, typical hunting distances back east. As long as you do your part, you're going to drop that deer or wild hog. I don't care where you go, by the way. The 44 Magnum cartridge is available everywhere. Well, at least within the United States, and for you handloaders out there, remember, it's a revolver cartridge. Totally easy to reload the brass. Easy to cast for. I know, I do it all the time. Sadly, Sturm, Ruger & Company no longer makes the Model 96 series. Given how neat a rifle it is, I couldn't figure out why. Couldn't be low sales figures. I thought the cowboy action shooters would be all over this thing. So, since I know a couple of cowboy action shooters, I asked them, "Hey, what's going on?" Well, turns out there is some kind of rule that says any gun's got to be designed before the year 1899. That means the Savage 99, and thus the Ruger 9644, are not eligible for cowboy action shooting competitions. Result, low sales numbers, and therefore Ruger quit making them a few years ago. However, that did mean one thing. I could get it for a darn good deal. See, apparently everyone seems to want cowboy guns. Well, this isn't a cowboy gun, and since I don't care about that, a good deal could be made, and I became a San Francisco liberal with a lever gun. In short, here's, just to sum it up, what makes lever-action rifles in this model in particular so cool. Number one, shoots a common revolver cartridge and gives it rifle-like power. Number two, handles just like the 10/22 that so many of us are already used to. Number three, the slickest, smoothest lever action I've ever encountered by a long shot. Number four, magazine replacement's just like a 10/22. Means it's pretty fast once you get used to it. Number five, same reliability as a 10/22, and for the same reasons. Six, shoots dead on. And seven, already machined for scope mounting. Unfortunately, since the 9644 is no longer made, all of them are going to be on the used market. If you can find one, consider it. They are sweet. And of course, if not a 9644, then a Rossi or Puma Model 92, or what I was originally looking for, a Marlin 1894, are also fine choices. Lever guns are just plain fun. You can use the exact same ammo for it that your revolver takes. Which is a perfect lead-in for our next cool gun. The classic double-action wheel gun. We're going to take a short break for station identification. See you in a little bit.
You can hear Gun Rights Radio Network on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or Palm phones. On demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Gun Rights Radio Network shows can be found under Sources.
Okay, we're back. We just got through talking about lever guns. Now let's talk about the merits of a revolver chambered for the same cartridge as your lever gun. Why do this? Simple. You only need to carry one type of ammo for both your rifle and your handgun. This is an idea that's, about 150 years old. The Winchester 4440 was, I believe, the first to do this. Someone correct me if I'm wrong, but it's definitely one of the first, if not the first. Well, now it's done with pretty much all the really common revolver cartridges, and it continues to be a really good idea. A six-shooter, folks, is a good thing to have. They are utterly reliable. They are easy to use. They are also easy to hand load for. As a companion piece to your lever gun or by itself, the double action revolver is about as practical as it gets, in my opinion. Yeah, you may only get 6 shots. This is compared to the semi-automatic pistols with their 17-round magazines. But there's a reason the cops back in the day used to say 6 for sure when talking about their wheel guns. Yeah, they had quote-unquote only 6, but they knew they get all 6. Revolvers can't stovepipe. They can be fired through a jacket or coat pocket if someone really absolutely has to. Overall length of the round isn't nearly as critical in a revolver as it is for a semi-automatic pistol. You know, this last point, that matters a lot more to hand loaders, but it is indicative of a revolver's versatility. You can shoot mild or wild loads in a revolver. The range of power you can use is a lot wider than in most semi-automatic pistols because you don't have slide springs to worry about. Your action is controlled and moved by when you pull the trigger. That's why you can shoot mild 38 special rounds out of your powerhouse 357 Magnum without any problems. I went and grabbed my Red Hawk, which I'm now holding. It's also chambered in 44 Magnum, just like my new to me, lever gun. Let's talk about this piece of firearms brutishness, because that's the word that comes to mind when I look at it or hold it. This is a big, heavy revolver. This gun is massive. I've put it up next door to the Smith & Wesson Model 29. That's Dirty Harry's famous 44 Magnum. A truly excellent gun. And the Red Hawk actually makes Smith & Wesson's Model 29 look small. That's an accomplishment, folks, since the Model 29 is not exactly a tiny wisp of a gun. It's fairly large in its own right. Oh, speaking of the Dirty Harry craze, the Red Hawk came out in the middle of it in 1978. Every time a new one of those films came out, everyone just had to have a 44 Magnum. Smith & Wesson couldn't turn them out fast enough. Huh. Enter Sturm, Ruger & Company. When they designed the Red Hawk, they basically took their 357 Magnum Security 6 and basically just made it bigger. Well, they added a couple improvements, too, while they were at it. Essentially, they designed the gun around the power of the 44 Magnum round. And you can see it, too. Like I said, the Smith & Wesson 44 Magnum is not a small gun. But you look at the top strap of the Red Hawk. It's twice as thick as the Smith's. The internal parts are enormously thick by comparison. It's got the triple lock style a mechanism for locking the cylinder. This is something that hasn't been seen since Smith & Wesson's original triple lock in 44 Special, first introduced in, 1907? Ruger brought it back, because it works. This thing's built to shoot full house 44 Magnum rounds all day, every day, for God knows how long and not break. Now, let's talk triggers. Smith & Wesson is known for their absolutely sublime triggers. To shoot a Smith & Wesson revolver like the Model 29, be it single action or double action, is just pure pleasure. It's like a fine Swiss timepiece. The Red Hawk, by contrast, it's more like a working man's Timex. Takes a licking and keeps on ticking. Now, I've got a Timex. I love it. Totally practical. And it's good looking, too. I wear it all the time. But let's face it, it ain't a Vacheron and Constantine, and neither is the Red Hawk. The trigger is not as sublime as on a Smith. However, it's actually not bad at all. Matter of fact, it's better than I expected after reading a bunch of these, Net Ninja reports out there that talk about how bad the Red Hawk's trigger supposedly is. Well, it turns out to be much smoother than I'd expected. It's also a lot less hard to pull than I had read. Heck, it's easy to shoot the gun. Well, assuming you can hold it up, it's kind of heavy. I would definitely recommend a two-handed grip for this big red just because of its weight alone. But load her up with either mild or wild loads. From the lightest 44 Special to the top-end 44 Magnum loads. And the party's on. The sights are very easy to use with a wide outline on the rear sight blade. Easy to see. The barrel comes in 4-inch, 5.5-inch, and 7.5-inch lengths. Mine's the 7.5-inch version, typically used for handgun hunting. That weight does have an upside. When you fire wild 44 Magnum rounds, it does not shatter your hands into 1,000 little bone fragments from the recoil. And that's because of the inertia of all that mass. This is a very good thing. I like my hand in one piece. And firing the light 44 specials, that feels like you're shooting a 22. The final thing that makes Red Hawks so cool to me is, well, their price. You just try and find a Smith & Wesson Model 29 in good condition for under $800. Oh, and forget about Colt's 44 Magnum, the Anaconda. You're looking at close to $1,500 for one of those, if you can find one. By contrast, I've regularly seen Red Hawks in mighty fine condition in the $500 range, and I've even seen them in the mid-400s. I don't know why such a fine revolver sells for so relatively cheaply, but it does. Well, that means mere mortals like me can afford them. Maybe it's because there are enough of them out there. You know, supply and demand. You know, kind of like with those Russian rifles, those Mosin-Nagants. Great fun, but lots of them out there, so prices are low. By the way, that's what'll be coming up next. We'll take another short break for station identification, and we'll see you back here in a few seconds, and we will get Russian on you, comrade. See you in a moment.
Gun Rights Radio Network. Podcasting freedom.
Mark, how are you, friend?
Hey, Doc Weston, how are you doing?
You're listening to the Barstool Discussion.
Welcome to Gunsmithing Radio with your host, Fred Zeglin.
You're listening to the Gun Review Podcast, a podcast that is made up entirely of gun reviews from the ordinary gun owner.
Hi, folks. Bob Main here with another episode of your weekly Handgun World Podcast.
This is Downrange Radio. And I'm your host, Michael Bain.
You are listening to the Personal Armament Podcast, Gimme Some Lumen Show. This is Rob Robidoux.
From the commander's chair of the Rolling Chicken Hammer Love Wagon Studio, it's the Road Gunner Podcast, coming at you with 80,000 pounds of concealed carry.
You're listening to Firearms Cafe. I'm your host, Tony Brown.
You're listening to the Gun Rights Advocates Podcast, and I am your host, Mark Vanderberg.
Welcome to the Practical Defense Quick Tip of the Week. I'm your host, Alex Addicks.
Live from sunny Live Oak, Florida, it's the Pro-Arms Podcast.
Now, your host for the Politics and Guns Podcast, Paul Lathrop.
Hello and welcome to episode 306. Wow, 206.
Of your weekly Gun Dudes Podcast.
Hello, gunslingers.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jim Fleming, and this is Reloading Radio.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Rimfire Podcast. My name is Ken Kowalski, and I'll be your host.
Shooting the Breeze, the formal gun podcast of WaltNPA.com. I am Walt White.
This is Doc Wesson, and in this episode of the Gun Nation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Armed Citizen Podcast. I'm your host, Mick McCart.
Welcome to the Survival Gun Show. My name is Chip Monk, and I'm your humble correspondent.
Every show on the Gun Rights Radio Network gets support from the network in one form or another, and the network needs your support to keep bringing you these podcasts. Please consider going to www.gunrightsradio.com/donate and becoming a subscriber to the network. A subscription is only $2 a month and does things like helping pay for servers and bandwidth. From time to time, the network receives donated products it uses to give away to subscribers, and this year it has an amazing prize to be awarded to one lucky subscriber. The Masada Yub Group has donated an $800 Mag 40 class to be given away, and all you have to do to be eligible to win the drawing is to be a subscriber to the network. More details to be released soon on the drawing and other prizes. So don't wait. Head over to www.gunrightsradio.com/donate and become a subscriber now to be sure you're eligible to win this fantastic training opportunity.
Greetings, comrades. We have here example of greatest rifle in world, Vintovka Mosina, glorious Mosin rifle. Only rifle in world to fight against itself and win each time.
Yes, folks, I've got the Mosin-Nagant in hand right now. Welcome to the Russian part of our show. This rifle is, yes, Russian, and later also Soviet military surplus. It's about equivalent to and in the same class as our Springfield M1903 or the German Mauser 98. The Mosin-Nagant M1891, its full number, series, predates both of those, both the Springfield and the Mauser 98, by the way. It came out in the year, well, 1891. Oh, for those of you who are paying attention to dates, you may know about this little rule regarding antique firearms. As we all know, for interstate transfers, you know, like you're buying a firearm from someone out of your state, you got to go through something called a federal firearms licensee, or FFL, in order to stay legal. Well, turns out anything built in 1898 or before is exempt from that requirement. It's called an antique. Since this rifle came out in 1891, 7 years before that, that means some of these rifles actually qualify under that legal exemption. Now, isn't that nice? That right there, just by itself, gets extra points for coolness. And there are actually a few of these older rifles left floating around. But suppose you buy an M1891/30, the most common sort. The /30 means it was either originally manufactured or refurbished by the Soviet arsenals, to the improved 1930 standard. That meant a few things. One of them is better sights. It also meant the rear sight was graded in the metric system using meters instead of the Imperial Russian arshins unit of measurement. Yeah, it's old and archaic. That's why the Soviets dumped it. Now, I've shot Mosin-Nagants. They shoot a 30 caliber round that dates from the 19th century, and it's still mass-produced today. It's called the 7.62x54 rimmed Russian cartridge. Looks kind of like a sleeker 30-30, really. It's a bottlenecked rimmed rifle case, just with a lot more power than the 30-30. It's about midway between the 308 Winchester and the 30-06 Springfield in terms of power. Mosin rifles kick just like any other military surplus bolt-action rifle with a steel butt plate and of similar power. It kind of hurts if you don't have some kind of padding, so I would definitely recommend you get a little padding of some sort, like, say, a limb saver. It's about as precise a shooter as the M1903 Springfield or the Mauser 98. Sorry, Springfield and Mauser fans, but it's true. It kills deer and other game just as dead as the Springfield and the Mauser do as well. It's got just as rich a military history as the Springfield or the Mauser. Well, hey, it's an old bolt-action military surplus rifle that was actually used in several wars. So, if it's basically the same as the others, what in the heck makes it so cool that I'd bother to mention it on the Liberals Gun Club? Two things. One, price of the gun, and two, price of the ammo. You gotta understand, folks, this gun was made by the millions, basically to fight off Nazi Germany and any other enemy who would dare attack Mother Russia or her allies. We did not want to have to face that gun any more than the Soviets wanted to face our M1 Garand. Sadly, we did, in Korea and Vietnam, and it wasn't pretty. The Mosin-Nagant works quite well, as our troops back then discovered. Former Governor Jesse Ventura, a Vietnam veteran, knows all about it. The rifle does its job with aplomb, and it's effective out past 800 meters. It works. Well, knowing this, the Soviets kept a bunch of them in Cosmoline preservative in case of World War III with the United States. Now, fast forward several decades. Cold War's over. The wall has been torn down. Russia's, mostly, our friend again. Yeah, that's a good thing. And Russia needs to update its arsenal with more modern stuff. They've got all those Mosins sitting there, perfectly preserved in Cosmoline. They need some cash. They get the bright idea to sell them to us over here in the United States. They know we like guns over here. They also know we have this little thing called the Second Amendment. Remember that rule about supply and demand? Millions of Mosin-Nagants. The Russians are basically selling them to the importers at near scrap metal prices. The importers turn right around and sell them to us for $100 or less. Yeah, that's right. These rifles, which are in the 308 Winchester to 30-06 class of power, typically sell for about $100, and they're accurate. To make that rifle today would probably be at least $400, maybe more. Can we say major bargain? I knew we could. Now to the ammo. The 7.62x54R cartridge has been in continuous production ever since 1891. To this day, it is the oldest living military cartridge. The Tula cartridge works and the Ulyanovsk cartridge works continue to spit out truckloads of these rounds, not just for Russia, but also for other militaries that use the same cartridge. You've heard of the M60 machine gun? Yeah, well, the Russian equivalent is called the PKM machine gun. The Russian PKM takes the 7.62x54R cartridge. So does the Dragunov sniper rifle used by their designated marksman. So, the 7.62x54R cartridge isn't exactly rare. They still make it. Truckloads of it. Lots of it. Therefore, Russia's also selling a bunch of their older so-called corrosive ammo. This stuff's from the 1970s and earlier. Some of it dates from the 1940s. All of it has been stored in climate-controlled environments for decades. And it works perfectly. Goes bang very nicely. I know, I've got some. Well, Russia's got megatons of this old ammo and they want to move it. Guess what that does for the price of that ammo? Bingo! Good times for us Yanks! The 7.62x54R military surplus ammo goes for dirt cheap compared to .30-06, 7.62x51 NATO. Oh gosh. 8x57 Mauser, 7.5x55 Swiss, any other kind of similar mil-serp rounds. At this point in time, oh gosh, it typically sells for what, 18 cents a round? And if you shop well, you can get it for as low as 15 cents a round. Even hand loaders are awfully hard-pressed to beat that kind of economics. Now, since all that older military surplus ammo is the so-called corrosive type, whoop-de-doo, all you got to do is just pour water down your barrel after you're done shooting, then clean as normal with, say, your hops number 9 or whatever. For you hand loaders out there, guess what? The Mosin Nagant is a bolt action. You got Boxer Prime brass cases? No problem. Neck size them. Even cast form. It's easy to do. And for those who are looking for the reloadable cases, oh, just buy ammo from Pervy Partizan. You know, they make them out in Serbia. They make Boxer Prime brass ammo. They make it all to American specs. You're taken care of, too. That's where you get your cases, and it's actually reasonably priced. For $100, I cannot imagine why everyone doesn't own one of these rifles. Talk about your bargains. Take another quick station ID break. Be back in about 30 seconds.
The forums are a great place to interact with the podcasters and listeners to your favorite podcast. Visit gunrightsradio.com and click on the forums button at the top of the page and sign up for your free membership, gunrightsradio.com.
Okay, this is our last cool gun for this episode. We got the semi-auto pistol here, a 9mm. This is the SR series, specifically the SR9. Yeah, I know, another Ruger. Well, here's why. This thing is basically Ruger's copy of the Glock design. You know, once the patents expired on Gaston Glock's admittedly revolutionary semi-auto pistol design features, it's like that old song said, "Send in the clones. There must be clones." Yeah, I know. Keep my day job, right? Well, anyway, everybody seems to make a Glockish type pistol nowadays, and it's for good reason. Gaston Glock came out with a real winner. Imitation being the sincerest form of flattery, you see a bunch of variations now from just about everybody. Well, of course, Ruger wanted in on this too, so they came out with their SR series. The first was the SR9 and 9mm, and that's the one I'm holding right now. Like most Glock-style pistols, this, you know, the magazine holds 17. Well, okay, in free America, it holds 17. For those who are still in Massachusetts or in California, it holds 10. Plus, you can have one in the chamber to make it a 17+1 or a 10+1. Like a Glock, the SR9 is ultra-reliable. It just doesn't quit. Here are Ruger's improvements to the basic design as far as I'm concerned. One, it does have an external safety, which is pretty non-obtrusive if you don't want to use it, especially for those of you who are used to Glocks. Two, You know how you got to pull the trigger to disassemble a Glock and similar type of pistols? The SR9 doesn't require that. I know we're supposed to double-check the firearm for clear before we take it apart. I triple-check them. But still, I like not having to pull the trigger just to disassemble the gun. You never know. 3. The price. You know, this is a recurring theme here. Anyway, I regularly see SR9s, and that also includes the 40 cal version, the SR40, for well under $400. Basically, you're getting a Glock 17 or a Glock 20 for $150 to $200 discount. That means you can buy more ammo, which is a good thing since the pistol does come with 2 magazines. Number 4. I really like the sights. They got bright white dots on them, easy to see, even for me. They're also fully adjustable, just like you'd expect. Number 5. Doesn't get hung up on clothing when you draw it from a jacket or coat pocket. The benefits there are obvious. Number 6. For a pistol that holds 17 rounds, it's remarkably slender. It's nowhere near as thick as, for example, Ruger's P95 series and some of the others that I've seen, like the double stack 1911s. It's light enough, and it's slender enough to reasonably carry in a decent-sized coat pocket. It's also got a reversible grip adjustment for smaller or larger hands. And number 7, recoil, even on the 40 cal version, is actually not that snappy. It's pretty friendly to new shooters. One other thing I like about the SR9, and this is really an operational thing that matters in a critical situation, seems more tolerant of limp wristing than several other pistols to include Glocks. Now, for those of you who don't know what this is, when you don't hold a semi-automatic pistol firmly, sometimes you get what's known as a stovepipe, where the spent case doesn't finish ejecting. That's one type of jam, and we don't like jams. All semi-auto pistols are susceptible to it in greater or lesser degrees. Glocks have been more susceptible, the SR series less so. To me, that's a real operational improvement. Just consider, especially if the attacker's bearing down on you right now, heaven forbid. Not perfect, though. Here's one area for improvement. The SR9's trigger does feel a little mushy and plasticky. It's not exactly a match trigger. But, you know, remember what it's for. It's not intended as a match pistol. It's a defensive, get-you-out-of-a-bad-situation-now tool. So you won't be thinking about the trigger if the time should ever come when you need the pistol. So it's a minor gripe, but it's not a fatal one. It does work, and it is reliable. Basically, you get virtually all the Glock goodness plus a few refinements for a discount price and with made-in-USA quality. It's hard to beat that. So, there they are. Now, I know I've mentioned 3 Rugers here along with 1 Russian piece. Seems a little lopsided, doesn't it? How come so many from one company? Well, it's for the same reason Timex watches are so popular, I guess. Recently, Sturm, Ruger & Company has made some really good guns, and you'll like other manufacturers do. But then they turned around and priced them at what I call mere mortal numbers. That means people like me, who aren't filthy rich, can afford them. I've got nothing against any other company's firearms. For example, I like full-size Glocks quite a bit, and especially the Glock 21 and 40 and 45 ACP. Fits my big paws really well. Matter of fact, I like it so much I probably will buy one when I save up enough money. Same for the Smith & Wesson M&P series, a military and police series. Very, very comfortable. We rent several of them regularly, and they're very popular. Beretta 92s, they feel almost like you're shooting a 22 LR, even though it's actually a 9mm. Very easy to shoot, very low felt recoil. Colt Pythons and Anacondas are just... ooh. If you've ever shot one, I don't need to explain. And I need not say anything more about the 1911s because enough people have already. Let's just say John Moses Browning was a genius. These are just a few of the guns that I think are really cool and that you might want to take a look at. Affordability for the quality was a big deal here, and bang for the buck definitely counted for coolness points. Big time. If you can, try one or more of these out. You can not only get a darn cool gun, you can do it at an affordable price. Oh, by the way, yeah, we will be talking about other guns down the road, too. No gun is safe from the Liberals' gun corner. Ha ha! We hope you enjoyed this gun-filled episode, and believe me, it was fun putting it together. This is Cowboy T signing off. Until next time, safe shooting, and thanks for listening.